Sensei. Obviously, as you know, Kisensei is a packed parsha, and every Aliyah has a lot, and certainly Shishi does as well. It's also fascinating, just in terms of synergy issues and the like, how we find sometimes that, and I really don't know if there's any explanation for this, that when we're doing the same Aliyah every week, that sometimes we find parallel themes from one week to the next. And you'll see that's very much true here, that this Shishi of Kiseitsei very much evokes themes of the Shishi in the past few weeks that we've been talking about. And really, this just picks up directly from last week's Shishi. It's really a pretty fascinating Hemshich. So, if you recall, last week we spoke about the issue of about those who go back from war, who don't continue on in war, and included in that category, and again this synergizes with our whole limud right now, are those who have been Mekadei Shemisha, but haven't yet been married, haven't yet done the suin. So here, the Aliyah starts off, Shishi of Kiseitsei, with the other side of that process. So what if there has been a full marriage? So then, says the Pasuk here, in Parak Chav Dalet of Dvarim, Pasuk A, Ki yikach ish isha chadasha, lo yetze b'tzava, lo yavur alav l'chol davar, nok yiyye l'veso shonei achas, v'simach ez ishto asher lakach. So here, we're talking about Nisuin. And again, here's this language of Asher Lakach, Ki Yikach, which has already been noted, probably is part of our discussion, whether Nisuin is a Kinyan, or is it a Kicha Lebeso. Maybe the language works for either one, so maybe it doesn't necessarily tell us one way or another, but it's certainly interesting. And here we're told that one who is in the state of very recent Nisuin is exempt from war and actually exempt from everything. That's essentially the point of the pasuk. Here the language is ki ikach ish isha chadasha. So what does chadasha mean? So here, Rashi quotes the idea that Chazal emphasized that it doesn't mean that she was never married before. It means chadasha lo. All it has to mean is that they haven't had a previous relationship. Like some of these used clothing stores have a sign, new to you. Right? So as long as it's chadasha lo, so then that's considered to be chadasha. So the only exclusion is for machzir brushasa. That if somebody remarries his own ex-wife, so then that's not included here. And that has halachic nafkaminas, because then the question is, does that reflect perhaps that there's a different degree or lower degree of simcha with a machzir brushasa? Apparently so. So that could have nafkaminas, for example, if one wants to get married on Chol Hamoed, so normally that's prohibited min haTorah, because we assume that there's a prohibition of ein ma'arvin simcha v'simcha. But if this reflects that there isn't full simcha with a machzir brushasa, so that affects that as well. But in any event, other than that, so whoever else you marry, whether she's an alman or a grusha, but as long as she wasn't your own ex-wife, so then, so now you have this period of a year. There's an interesting chakira in some of the svarim that what if you were Makadi Shanisha and then you divorced her before Nisuin, or I guess maybe after Nisuin, but with the middle of the first year, and then you remarry her, it's still time to go on the first year. So then you have a prorated first year. So that's an interesting, very specific question. But in any event, under normal circumstances, here we're told that there is this period of Shon Rishon. And Rav Hirsch has a theme here which he emphasizes throughout, that even though we're talking about Mochama, last week's Parsha, this week's Parsha, well, Parsha is called Kiseitsei, we have this theme of Kiseitsei and Mochama throughout. And yes, it's important that we come together as a nation for that. But the nation, we are always reminded that the nation is made up of individuals. So the individuals also have to be happy, so we try to accommodate that, and we have this exemption for we have this exemption for the recent chassid. So there is a whole discussion, and it's also it's going to be major synergy for us. So the simach as ishto. So how do you translate that? Does that mean that he should gladden his wife, or does that mean that he should celebrate with her? So Rashi addresses this, right? The simach, Rashi writes, Yisamach es ishto, the sargumo, the achdei, yas, is to say, which basically translates to mean that he should make her happy. And then he goes on to say, this is an apparent reference to the Targum Yonasan ben Aziel, who says the way that he's about to criticize, Hamasargim, the echdei, im, is to say, which would mean he should celebrate with his wife, Toa, who had some mistakes, Einze Targum Shol Vesimach, Ella Shol Vesomach. So if the Torah said Vesomach, it means they should celebrate together, but the language is Vesimach, that more accurately translates into one should gladden his wife. But still, it is a discussion back and forth as to what exactly is the focus, and you find we've shown him perhaps taking different sides. Hi.
Spelled the same way.
Right, but then the question is, we rely on the Masora, so then what is the Masora telling us?
Could there be a different Masora that says Masama?
There could have been, but it doesn't seem like there is. Right, so we have the whole Torah Kula, right, that we rely on issues of punctuation, Lahalacha, that they are concrete, that they mean something, and sometimes we have a Kriya Miksiv, and we have a Pasuk, which reads one way, and there is a Masorah to read it a different way, and then there's a whole discussion. The Gemara has a whole discussion. Yeshem LeMikri, Yeshem LeMasorah. So when there's different versions, so then there's a discussion on how to interpret it, and then presumably also there's a reason why it's conveyed in two different versions. But here, so we have the tradition that that's what the word means, even though, yes, it's spelled the same way, but that's how it's read. So therefore, this is how Rashi and the Sefer Ayin and the Onkelos all translated that the Simach as Ishto. But if you look at the Sefer Achinuch, so it sounds like from Sefer Achinuch, this is Tafkuf Hei Beis, the Sefer Achinuch does seem to understand that it's a mutual process, and it's kedai to read, because this very much fits in with our whole sugi here. That is, basically, this kind of like really picks up from what we've been talking about in the context of Kedushin. So we've talked about the mitzvah of Kedushin, which is generally a position shared by the Rambam and the Sefer Achinuch, the same similar perspective, that the mitzvah of Kedushin is for purposes of seriousness and stability and the like. So to hear the Sefer Achinuch in discussing this mitzvah, he says that there's an interest in the world in stable family units, and avoiding znus, and avoiding people just wandering from one partner to the other. So therefore, we want to do whatever we can to encourage affection between the spouses, and getting used to each other, and focusing on each other. So therefore, we ideally set aside this time period so that they can do that. They can focus on each other, and they don't have other distractions. And Sefer Achinuch also writes, this is true with Zman HaZeh also, this wasn't a mitzvah that was only in the time of the Torah. So clearly we have a very reduced ability in our culture to fully absorb this value, and that's the whole discussion. Maybe focus more on what the theme is than the actual pratim, because our scenarios don't really allow for all of it to play out the same way. But there's clearly a very powerful message, and the question of where does the year come from? That's also, well, the year comes from the Torah. Why does the Torah formulate the year if that is the idea? So how do we know it takes a year? So the Targ Tzvimah has an interesting comment, which you got to put together with some other things. He doesn't do it this way, but it's interesting, a little intra-parsha synergy. So the parsha ends off next year's topic in Shvi, the end of Parsha Shvi, say we have the mitzvah of Zechiras HaMalach. So we know from our practice that we perform the mitzvah of Zechiras HaMalach, at least in a full Kriyas HaTorah sense, we do that once a year. So it's a question, why do we do it once a year? And how does the Pasuk say once a year? The Pasuk says to remember HaMalach, how do we know how often we're supposed to do it? So there's an idea that's attributed to the Chassam Sofer. It's more from the students of the Chassam Sofer who quote this. It's a little bit questionable for a couple of reasons, so it's worth a debate. But there's an idea that's associated with the Chassam Sofer that the Torah says by Amalek, Losishkach, that we should remember and we shouldn't forget. So what's the prohibition of forgetting? How do you know what it means not to forget? So he came up with this idea that maybe there's a sheer shikha, that if a certain period of time passes and you don't remind yourself, so then that's tantamount or will lead to forgetting. And then he comes up with the idea that that sheer shikha is a year. How do you know it's a year? So basically because there are two gemaras. One is a gemara in Brachos, which says that Ein hameis mishtakeach minalev ela achar yud beis chodesh, that it takes a year for somebody who passed away for the people to start to get past it. And the second paragraph of Metzia, when the Gemara talks about Yeish, it's also a topic of Vespers Parsha, somebody loses something and he has Yeish about getting it back. So Stam Yeish, you assume a person has Yeish after yud beis chodesh. So based on that, Maram Shik was a great Talmud of some sort, you find this in his writings, that apparently 12 months means you're going to forget something, and therefore you have to remember Amalek every 12 months so you shouldn't come to forget. And then that leads to a whole story, because if that's the idea, so this past year was a leap year, so there are 13 months. You add an extra month at the worst time, right before Adar, right before you're about to perform the mitzvah of Zechiras Amalek again. So then it's a whole discussion as far as, is that a problem? We say 12 months, now it's 13 months. What are we going to do? Should we have kavanah in the summertime? Now we read Kiseitse to, late summer, to fulfill Amalek again, because maybe too many months pass. If it's 13 months, that's a whole discussion. So all of this revolves around this idea that there's a sheer shikha based on these makoros. And not everybody agreed with the whole idea. So Sadler Rav, for example, in his Chuvus, he says he doesn't think there's the truth to that. And he thinks that these Gemaras don't prove it. Because, first of all, we talk about in a meis mishtakeach minalev, it doesn't mean that you automatically forget something after 12 months. It means when there's a process of breathing and people are trying actively to get past something, after 12 months it starts to work. It doesn't mean that otherwise you automatically forget. And also the Gemara about Yeish is not about forgetting, it's about giving up hope of getting it back. So after 12 months you give up hope that your lost property is going to be returned. But that's not the same as forgetting, so it's a whole fight about that. But it's interesting that the Torah Tamima here on this pasuk, without getting into the whole discussion about Amalek, etc., but those same sources about the Yeish and about the Enevesh Mishpakeach Nalev, so he says apparently to have Hesech Hadas from somebody, that's a 12-month process. So maybe the opposite is here as well. That maybe if you want to have whatever you call the opposite of Hestach Hadas, you want to have Super Das about somebody, so maybe that's also a 12-month process. I guess you could say it's like Kepolto Kachbolo, the same way you would forget it, that's how you would bring it in, kind of a reverse what we find in Kashrus. And that's why the Torah says a year. So there's a lot here until you have to put together. Because again, the Torah Tamim is not explicitly connecting it to the controversial concept by Amalek. He's just using the same Gemaras. And there, in Amalek, we don't have any source that a year is real. We're figuring out based on these Gemaras. So here, in this case, a year, the Torah tells us a year, and he's applying this thought that maybe it's the opposite. It's hard to believe that's really how the mind works, that it takes a year to forget something, you need a year of intense chazara to remember it. That's probably not the most intuitive thought, but that's the notion that he brings up in this context. A fascinating idea. Tough kuf pei beis. So yeah, that's Sefer HaChinuch. It clearly, hashkafically, fits in very strongly with what we've been talking about in terms of marriage and in terms of general values of marriage. So here he's just taking it one step further, that we said that we want to have Kiddushin for the purposes of family stability, that the Rambam is saying, and the like. And so he says also, so you want to have family stability, so not only should they get married, but they should spend the year really focusing on each other to try to give it as much staying power as possible. There's some discussion in the Svarim, is this about gentleman. That Sefer Chinuch also, is this about generating a family also? Maybe that's why it's a year, because then maybe after a year, maybe there'll be children, and then that's a different point to focus. So that's a whole discussion, a fascinating idea. Here also, the pasuk really talks about a lot of things. Shouldn't have to do anything. Before that, it says, Lo Yetzei Pitzava, so you shouldn't go out into the army. So here, if you look, some of the Rishonim seem to say that here Rashi focuses on Tzava here, and some understand that the issue is that we're afraid he's going to die. So somebody who just got married, so we have a greater protection for him, and we should avoid the Tzava. But the Rambam, it's clear he's talking about you can't make him do anything, not just he can't be forced to join the army, but also any other responsibility he should be kept free from. Chassam Sofer has a tshuva in Adam Ezer, Chelik Beis is in the Kufkin Hay, but Chassam Sofer writes that if the war was going on before they got married or when they got married, so then maybe that's different, because then maybe we could assume they got married knowing there was a war going on, and it's also not the point that you're supposed to get married to avoid the war, but the other way around. So therefore, maybe that could explain the practice that nowadays we don't assume that a chassan is putter from the war, and certainly not contemporary Israel is that the assumption. I remember very powerfully that I was myself in Eretz Israel several years ago, and had an opportunity to visit in the hospital a very well-known miraculous situation. There was a wounded soldier who was known at the time simply as Hachatan. He had just got married, I think, the day before, and went right out to the battlefield, and was horribly injured in the battlefield right the day after his wedding. And Baruch Hashem, he has made a tremendous recovery since then, and has not 100%, but he's done. He's gone on to have children since then, and he's had miraculous improvement, but it was a tremendous story at the time. And he got to visit with his family and him in the hospital, and he was known simply in the press that it's a chatan, because he just mamash come right from his chuppah to the war, and this is what happened. So we have a very different approach than what's described in Pesukim, but again, this is what the Chassam Sofer perhaps is describing. The war predates the wedding, so then that's understood that that's the situation that we're getting into. And some suggest that maybe it's not just about the war, but it's about everything else, that that's the chinuch statement that we said, that this should apply to Zman Hazeh, so we don't see anybody getting a full year off from everything if they get married. So maybe that's also the idea that we all know that life is moving, the world isn't stopping to turn, but you know, for the newlyweds, so then died to the huffing and got married, but maybe otherwise it could have been a different understanding. Hi.
Isn't there a difference between
Melchata
and
Shura? So yeah, that's also a possible discussion. How exactly to mention last week a little bit. The discussion.
It wouldn't matter.
They
have to go, right?
So that's also, it sounds like from Gemara and Sota that we discussed a little bit last week. So, right, which is also, you're saying, true in terms of the contemporary context, which is all self-defense, but also, it's also the case. Yeah. All right, in any event, so the next pasuk seems like it's talking about something completely else, but Rav Hirsch connects it to his theme, which I'm sure Paul Hirsch. So the pasuk says, right after this, Lo yachavol rechayim v'rachav, ki nefesh hu kovel. It seems like this is just completely out of nowhere, in terms of the flow from the previous pasuk. It doesn't seem to have anything to do with it, that when a person lends somebody money, so he has a right to take a mashkon, he has a right to protect his loan, to protect his principal, but he shouldn't take that which is crucial for making a living. So here the pasuk uses to symbolize that, rechayim v'rochev, these are two parts of a millstone, the upper part, the lower part, because this is his livelihood, this is what a person needs in order to function. And here again, the synergy is pretty striking because in the past 2 weeks, in Parshas Shoftim and in Parshas Re'eh and our Shishi slots that we've been reading about Shemitas Ksafim, about the tremendous sensitivity we have to providing loans to people in need and the protection that's there for the borrower. So this is related to that as well. And again, that yes, you're entitled and maybe even encouraged to take a mashkon, but there are rules and parameters to how you take the mashkon and what you do with the mashkon. So here it's really just picking up from the same themes we've been seeing in the past 2 weeks. And also, nefesh shukovo. So this is an important idea also, because last week, if you recall, so we read about Hasagas Gvul. And Hasagas Gvul has been interpreted in the later svarim to refer to ruinous competition. We didn't get a chance to spend as much time on that topic as we had hoped to. Maybe we'll, on a Sunday, talk about that in the context of Shiduchim, at least, competition by Shiduchim. I think that's a potential Sunday topic coming up after Yantif. But the idea that the pasuk of Hasagas Gvul has been interpreted to mean you shouldn't be what's called more technically in the Talmud's language, Yored L'Chavero, Yored L'Omenos Chavero, that there is this idea that a person's livelihood is not just his life, it's everything, it's something that we have to be very, very careful with. So if that's the idea, so then the pasuk kind of emphasizes that also, that whatever somebody needs to make a living, kinafishu, this is mamish's livelihood, they have to take it very, very seriously. And the idea that something they need for their parnasa, you would take as a mashkon, that's got to be understood as off-limits. So I started to say before about how this pasuk sounds like it's got nothing to do with the previous pasuk, but Rav Shamshon Fal Hirsch makes the similar comments in both, because he had said that the previous pasuk was about recognizing that even though we function militarily and otherwise as one unit, we still have to worry about all the individuals in the unit, that they should have their proper individual happiness. So that's true, individual versus society, which is what the previous pasuk was. And this pasuk is about individual versus individual, that yes, you have a right to have your assets protected by taking collateral, but you also have to recognize, are you devastating somebody else by taking away his ability to make a living? That's not okay, and that's where there's a trade-off, and it's similar in that sense. That's the flow between the two psukim. They're both about saying, yes, there is a big goal here, but that big goal is not allowed to step on the individual, and these are two different ways in which the individual's protection comes before something else. Okay? So, speaking of individual protection, so the next pasuk, again, seemingly in a big shift, talks about kidnapping. So the pasuk says, ki imatze. What does it mean, ki imatze, in general? So when the Torah says ki imatze in a context like this, generally means a person is found to have done something. In the sense, like we said in English, he's found guilty. So what do we mean he's found guilty? Meaning there are eidim, that if it's established through the bezdin, through eidim, that something happened. So what happened? Ish goniv nefesh me'achav b'nei Yisrael. Somebody has kidnapped somebody else. And he put him to work as a slave, and he sold him. So that is a chiyuv misa. So what happens? So it's a chiyuv misa. We find the Torah often saying, v'yartara mikavecha, in that context. And this individual is chiyuv misa for the kidnapping. So one question you could ask, okay, I think we understand that kidnapping is bad, and it's a serious crime. So just one interesting word to possibly seize on in this pasuk and to discuss if it has halachic ramifications. So what does the word gonev mean normally? Gonev. Well, what does gonev mean? It has a specific halachic meaning, right? What does it mean?
Stealing what's not there.
Stealing, sorry?
Stealing.
Right, so it means stealing, and that there is the secrecy component, right? We know from the Gemara, from elsewhere, that there's a chiluk that is drawn between geneva and gezela. So normally, gezela is done out in the open, so I'll come up to you and I'll grab something out of your hands, or I'll put a gun to your head and I'll take it from you openly, while geneva is done with secrecy. And we know geneva has a greater stigma to it in halacha. in that you have to pay kefal for your neighbor but not for gazela. And the Gemara says that God is particularly offended by the ganav because the gazel is just crazy, doesn't care about anybody. But the ganav takes the effort to hide from people, but he doesn't care that God is watching. So normally that's a distinction that we have, that that's what ganav is as opposed to gazela. So you would think also that ganav means that the victim doesn't see who's taking it. That's generally what's happening. So how do we use the word geneva? How do we understand the word geneva in this context if it's talking about kidnapping? And does it have a specific meaning which excludes something else? So that's a discussion. The Chassina understands that it's talking about gonev specifically and not gozel. So if you were to take someone openly, then that would not be subject to the fee of Nisa. So now you have to figure out, I mean, how the victim always knows he's being taken, right? That would seem to be hard to miss, right? So it's if somebody takes your wallet from your pocket, or somebody sneaks into your house when you're not there, so you can understand, okay, there's a geneva happening that somebody pulled off without you realizing it until it's too late. But if you're kidnapped, you're kind of going to probably notice, unless you're really tired. So what exactly is going on here to make such a distinction? So the Netziv writes here in the Chumash, his commentary to the Chumash, that if a person who's doing it wears a mask, if he makes any effort to try to conceal who he is, so that's geneva, even if the person who's being taken knows that he's being taken. This distinction that Cheskinov makes is also earlier in the Shulchan Aruch of Tzal Ashkenazi and Simchat Lametz. The Sal Ashkenazi was the editor of the Shittim of the Betzas, a collection of Rishonim that we have on various Masechtas. So the Sal Ashkenazi in his Chuvas, he makes the same chilut, and he explains why it is. He says that he thinks there's a difference in the egregiousness of harm, that when it's known who has kidnapped someone, so then people can get him back, because they'll know where to go, and he's working off the assumption that there's a ransom that can be paid, there's something that can be done. So it's pretty upsetting, I would have to imagine, but not as bad as when it's done secretly. We have now we have what happens with ISIS and other groups, and it's open, and they wear masks also, but I mean, doesn't seem like much of a nechama, but that's how he understands that. Maybe that's a little different. Rav Nachum Zemba disagrees. Rav Nachum Zemba, same sefer that we mentioned earlier in the week or last week, so there's a little synergy on that. So we mentioned Rav Nachum Zemba's letters to Avraham Lochteberg, it's from the sefer Zera Avraham. So now back to that sefer, same sefer as Zera Avraham. So Rav Nachum Zemba disagrees with this whole distinction. And he says that the ikar about kidnapping is that a person is separated from his family, from his relatives. So vis-a-vis the relatives, it's generally going to be hidden who it is no matter what, even if the person who got taken sees who's doing it. So therefore, the word geneva is appropriate, and there's no real distinction. Any kind of kidnapping can be called geneva, and that's what we're talking about. Ruth and Fischl Perlow, hi. The question is, like, why does the Torah use the word geneva here? Does geneva mean to suggest that it's done specifically secretly, and that if it was done openly, then it's not going to be the same story? And isn't it generally done openly? Because if you're being kidnapped, don't you generally know about it? So to that, Rav Nachum Zemba says, no, there's no such distinction. We're focusing on the family members. So the family members, it's done without their knowledge, and then they find he's missing later. So for them, it's always as a geneva. It's always something that happened when they weren't around to see it. And therefore, there's no distinction. All kidnapping is the same problem. And that's why the Torah uses that word, which has that connotation. If you're from Fischl Perlow, who, if you're familiar with that sefer, there's a sefer of Psajigon on the Torah, and on the mitzvah. It's a sefer of mitzvah, so Psajigon. So if you know that, you have that sefer. So it's really a poem. Couple pages long, but there was a businessman who found time to learn while he was working in business, named Rabbi Fischl Perlow, who wrote a commentary on the Sefer HaMitzvos of Rav Sajagon, and made it into three huge volumes. So this poem is now three humongous volumes. And in that Sefer, so Ruchel Fischel Perlo, so he also rejects any such distinction. He says that the issue is kidnapping, it's all Chayav Yisa. And the reason that the Torah uses the word Gneva is, he says, Dibur HaKasav Behoved, which means the Torah talks about the present situation, which is a way of saying sometimes the Torah talks about the most common situation. It doesn't necessarily mean to exclude other situations. So most commonly, the people who are most susceptible to kidnapping are little children. So little children, maybe they don't know what's going on. They don't know who's doing it. So the children will always perceive it as a gneva. And therefore, because they're the most likely to be kidnapped, so that's why the Torah uses that word. But again, it's not meant to exclude any other type of kidnapping, and all kidnapping is treated the same. It's all chayav yisa. Okay, so now we have another two psukim, which change the subject yet again, and bring up a very, very major issue for us. So next pasuk says, and whether the pasuk is relevant to us today or not, it depends on what focus you put on it. It's either humongously relevant or seemingly a little bit less relevant. But the pasuk says, Hishomer v'nega hatzaratz, v'shmor v'od v'lasos, v'chol asher yoru v'schem hakohanim alaviv, kasher tzivisa and tishmu v'lasos. So let's say somebody should have tzaratz, so there are all kinds of rules, you have to follow the rules. So on the surface, the pasuk is saying, be careful with tzaraas. There are a couple of different levels of meaning to this pasuk. The Gemara also understands it to mean that if somebody has one of the manifestations of tzaraas in his body, so he shouldn't cut it off. He has to go through the process, and he shouldn't remove it. So that's what the Torah is saying here. Be careful with the negative tzaraas. Don't do anything to damage the evidence. The Gemara says there's an exception if it's a baby, and it's the makam hamila, so then the mitzvah of mila outweighs this. The mitzvah of mila is dofa, this isser. But without that, there's an isser of tzitzas baharis, of cutting off the tzaraas, of doing anything to remove it. Jed?
Why would we believe, what exactly would bring about that situation of a baby getting tzaraas and mila? And I know that we had a concept that tzaraas
right. And which we're going to get to by itself, not necessarily to answer that question, but yeah, I don't know how exactly, hashkafically to explain. Maybe we could theorize, but it's a little bit beyond us to explain how that would happen. But theoretically, the Gemara says, should that be the situation? So then the mila would be mutter, but other than that, there is a isser of cutting off of the haris. So it's a whole discussion whether saras applies nowadays. There's no explicit source that says that tzaraas is not relevant nowadays. We just tend not to see it. That's what it seems like, because the Rambam in Hilchos Tzaraas, the Rambam writes that tzaraas is relevant bein ba'aretz, bein b'chutz la'aretz. It's not an Eretz Yisrael concept. The Gevatim is a different story, but at least in terms of tzaraas in the body. And it's not something that's tied to the Beis HaMikdash, with Bein B'fnei HaBayis and below B'fnei HaBayis. So maybe we have tzaraas today. How do we know that we don't have tzaraas? Why do we assume that the dinim of tzaraas don't seem to really apply to us? So, okay, it happens to be we don't think that we see it, but how do we know it can show up at any moment? So the Radbaz writes in his commentary to the Rambam that we need a kohen miyuchas, we need a real kohen to address the tzaraas, so we won't be able to actually observe the dinim of tzaraas because we don't have the process to address it. And the Chafetz Chaim writes in his Sefer that the idea, which we'll expand on in a moment, that tzaraas is there as a response to certain averos, most well known Lashon Hara, but other averos as well. So the idea seems to be that that's not there just to make us miserable, but that's there as a redemptive process, that's there as a tikkun. So there shouldn't be any such thing, and maybe there isn't any such thing, as tzaraas without a way to deal with it. And if we don't have the coding, we don't have the whole structure to deal with tzaraas, then there's no point in having Saras in the first place. They're meant to come together, and bottom line, maybe that's why we don't tend to see it nowadays.
How would we have a concept of Saras if it was a Jewish history, if it's impossible for it to happen?
So that's a question that's also beyond us. We don't know if it's true for most of Jewish history. I mean, we have a lot of dinim which are limited in time and history where they when they apply to. And actually, you're asking the question in a way that I can kind of build off in infomercial fashion. So thank you for timing that question exactly perfectly. You know, Parshas Kisetse itself, if we want to go back to Rishon, if that's legal under our rules. So we start off with Eish Faz Tor, and then with Ben Sora Remora. And so Ben Sora Remora, as we know, we don't tend to see that process happening too much either. And according to one opinion in the Gemara, Lohaya Vlasa Lios. Didn't happen. There never was a Ben Sora Remora in history, and there never will be. And there are two other examples in the Gemara, one of which is Nigei Batim, that's Aras to the house. Yeridach, that's also so certain mitzvos which never happened, never going to happen. So the Gemara asks in Sanhedrin, if they never come up in real life, so then why does the Torah include them? Why does the Torah give dinim? Not just you're asking a very limited time, what if they never happen ever? So then why are they there? So the Gemara has this answer, Drosh v'kabel schar, that we should study the topic and get schar. So it's a big question what that line means, because it's the intent that, oh, the Torah doesn't have enough for us to learn, so we have to have a few extra mitzvos that maybe we don't actually have an applicability in real life, but at least we can get smart on the Torah. So yes, we have so much, we could spend our whole lives easily on the things that actually do come up. So why do we need extra mitzvos just for the purposes of star? So there are a couple of approaches. The Ramban writes in one place that the entire Torah is a remez, is a Shem Hashem in a long form, and it's a mashal for God. And most of the mashal, 99.9% of the mashal, I guess it comes out to 99.5% of the mashal, could express itself in terms of things that actually come up on planet Earth, and a small percentage had to be expressed in terms of things that don't actually happen. But there's another attitude that to sell Salanter, the base of Levy like this, say that it's there to show that even though we're very much into learning halacha l'maisa, and that's very important, and we say that the highest madrega of learning is la suke shmaisa lupa behelchasa, and we like to be lomer namanas lasos, etc., but there is still an importance to Talmud Torah in of itself, separated from any practical applicability, and that sometimes we want to emphasize that even when there won't be any l'maisa, we still learn that and show that there's a Hashivas to Talmud Torah separate from the L'maisa component. We don't spend that much time on it because there's so much that is L'maisa, but we have at least something which is kind of set aside to be not L'maisa at all. But in addition to those explanations, I think there's another level here that, say, Drosh V'Kavos Schar, so there's a message that all the mitzvot of Torah have their direct applicability, but they also have other meanings which transcend the details of that specific situation. We said a few minutes ago, talking about Shana Rishona, that we're not really able to realize it nowadays the way the Torah describes it, but we still can try to understand what the overall value is. So too, there are dinim in the Torah that, all the dinim in the Torah really exist on both levels, that they're there to be practiced literally, and they're there also to tell us values that we're supposed to darshan and to apply. So basically, maybe what the Gemara is saying is that Ben Sora Remora, that kind of drastic situation where the child actually gets executed, okay, that much doesn't ever come up. It's never going to really play out that way. But the parish of the Torah is a very important one because you can darshan it, and you can profit, so to speak, get reward from the drasha. You will find a lot to learn and to apply even outside the scope of the mitzvah itself. So that kind of resonates because if you read the section about Ben Sora Remora, so how many drashas, literally, and how many speeches in shul are based on Ben Sora Remora? How many educational messages do we get out of Ben Sora Remora? There's a tremendous, to be very literal, it's a tremendous drasha potential that comes out of it. And that essentially, that could be the Gemara's point also, that don't worry so much about whether the exact parameters will play out. If they play out, we'll talk about it. But just because a specific mitzvah may never express itself fully in the real world doesn't mean there isn't tremendous value for us to expound and to learn from. So that's definitely true also when it comes to Negayim. And usually that time of year, end of Shmos, Vayikra, when you talk about Parsha Shir, I usually give a little introduction about this, that part of the Torah about Karbonos and about the Mishkan and about Negayim as well. So we don't encounter that in our real lives, but it's just as relevant to us anyway because of the themes. And therefore, maybe Adarabba, we pay even more attention to these sections as one as that, because it's primarily speaking to us on that level, and that all these details we should pay attention to and try to mind them for their hashkafic and lusser value. So just to give one maramakam on that, this pasuk specifically, there is a sefer called Hadrash V'Hayyun. It was a very revered teacher here, one of my rabbis, by Dr. Aaron Levine, Zephyr Tzadik Lebracha, was the head of the economics department, and a giant in the field of business and halacha. So he was named after his grandfather, who was also Aaron Levine. Aaron Levine, the elder, was known as the Reish Rav in Poland. He was actually a member of Polish parliament. And he wrote Svarim, so it's a sefer, Shalos Mishubas Avni Chayfetz, and it's a sefer on Chumash called Hadrash V'Ayin. So Hadrash V'Ayin, I guess also appropriately named here. So on this pasuk, he has a long, long drasha on the symbolism of all of the Negayim and what they're meant to convey and the different attitudes. If we were to go through it, it would take up more time than we have. But if you want to see an example of how somebody will get a lot of homiletic impact out of these themes, so you could look at that paper I draw for you on this pasuk. That's a long, long essay on the current day moral hashkafic message of Yishamar Ben Eged Saras. But even without all those details, this pasuk is tremendously relevant to us, because the idea of Yishamar Ben Eged Saras to us relates most directly to Lashon Hara. And this might be one of the mitzvos that tells us about the Yisur Lashon Hara. And the Medrash darshins was pasuk to that point, that Hishamar Beneged Tzaras means be careful with that which causes Tzaras. That's what the pasuk is saying. And therefore, what's it talking about? It's talking about Lashon Hara. So the Maharil and the Hilchos Aseres Me'Tshuva, finally, so the Maharil writes that that's actually the source in the Torah. There's a whole discussion. What's the main source in the Torah for the Yisur Lashon Hara? So there are various candidates that are more popular, but the Maharil says the source is this pasuk, Yishamar Beneged Tzaras. The Torah is telling you that you should be careful with that which causes Tzaras. This is the Yisur Lashon Hara. Now, you could ask, well, okay, but we know there is a link between Tzaras and Lashon Hara, but Chazal actually tell us that there are a number of other avayros also, so the pasuk might just mean stay away from lots of avayros. I don't know specifically Lashon Hara. So the truth is, the link to Lashon Hara is a little bit greater. You know, we talk about, we darshan about Lashon Hara, Parashas Tazria V'Tzora, and that's the two parashios that are most explicitly about Tzaras, and the word V'Tzora, Chazal tell us, is a contraction of Motzi Shein Ra, that's the theme. That's the cause, but that there are other causes as well. But the truth is, the linkage is really much more explicit from Parshas Baloska. Because in Parshas Baloska, the Torah tells us about Miriam's Lashon Hara. And right after that, she gets Tzaras. So the direct linkage between Lashon Hara and Tzaras, which we associate again with Mitzvah and the like, but it's much more explicit there. That's where the Torah really shows it with Miriam and her Tzaras. And that's the topic of the next pasuk, which we will give more attention to in a moment. So the next pasuk talks about Miriam. So the Maharil, when he says his idea that the pasuk Kishama Benegat Tzaras is mostly about the Yisur Lashon Hara, so he says, how do you know that out of all the possible avayros connected to Tzaras, that Lashon Hara is the issue? Because the next pasuk reminds us of Miriam, and therefore that's relevant. Chavetz Chaim, he was asked, why did he give so much attention to his farim, to Lashon Hara, and write so many farim about Lashon Hara? So he pointed to this pasuk and he said, where do you find the pasuk of the Torah? And again, he's now working off the assumption that the real subject is Lashon Hara. But where do you find the pasuk in the Torah that comes down so hard? Hishamer v'negasaras, lishmor, ma'ov, tishmeru, lasos. They have three different usages of the word shmira. And shmira is the language of Moshe said. So clearly the Torah is making a very big deal about this. And therefore this is something we have to pay a lot of attention to. So either this pasuk is telling us to focus strongly on Lashon Hara, or the next pasuk is, or they both are together. But in any event, the next pasuk, even more so, the next pasuk tells us, Zachar eis asher asa shem lokach miriam, baderech, baderech b'seis chamim mitzrayim. You should remember what God did to Miriam. So this could be an eitza. That's how it sounds like the Rambam and others understand this, that the first pasuk, the previous pasuk, was saying, stay away from Lashon Hara. And if you need help staying away from Lashon Hara, so remember what happened to Miriam, that'll scare you, that will keep you out of Lashon Hara. So some understand that as an eitzah question. So some understand that as advice, and since it connects to the previous pasuk, is a good way to keep yourself away from Lashon Hara. But the Ramban says that it's more than this. The Ramban writes that this is a real mitzvah. This is the language, same language we have by Zechiras HaMalik, by Zechiras HaShabbos, that this is one of the 613 mitzvahs. And he writes that in his commentary to Chumash over here. And he writes it also in his Hosafos to the Rambam, that the Rambam Sefer HaMitzvahs, and all of you mentioned this the other day, you mentioned in the context of, came up the other day somewhere, but the Ramban writes that he has his attacks on the Rambam in general, and in the back, all the attacks he couldn't put anywhere because the Rambam didn't list the mitzvah in the first place. So he has what he calls the mitzvahs shashachach HaRambam. And the mitzvahs the Rambam forgot, and this is one of them. Ironically, he forgets the mitzvah about remembering. But he says this is a real mitzvah. It's unlikely the Rambam really forgot, and that's a funny way of saying it. But if I didn't agree with the mitzvah, so I'm just sitting at home saying, you should learn it as well. All right, it's at the printer, already. I'll leave it. Pashas, it's a machlokas, but in any event, so the Rambam writes the mitzvahs the Rambam forgot. So one of them is this mitzvah. Remember, Miriam is a real mitzvah. It's one of the 613 mitzvahs. So if that's the case, so a couple of questions. So first of all, so what does that expect us to do? So when it comes to Amalek, so we have a whole Kriyas HaTorah. When it comes to other mitzvahs of Zechira, we have different ways of handling it, which is an interesting subject in itself, a little bit beyond our time slot for today to talk about all the mitzvahs of Zechira and why they're handled differently. But the question in general why that is, many have a practice to just recite them straight out as psukim at the end of davening, for example. It's generally assumed there are six zechiros, but there are different counts. And you have anywhere between four and nine mitzvahs of zechira, depending on how you count them. So many have a practice of just reciting them every day. So it's a question of what exactly is the chiyuv that comes here. That's a discussion. Moshe Feinstein has a tshuva about it. Others talk about this. Some say that it's not any specific act, but it's literal, that it's a general sense of awareness that you should remember Miriam. So there's a lot to say about this. Maybe more time than we have to see. We'll try to go quickly. But one could ask, okay, so then what's the purpose of this mitzvah? So the Ramban says, well, you can understand the purpose of the mitzvah is to keep us away from Lashon Hara. So you could say, well, that sounds nice, but we have so many mitzvahs in the Torah that are bad, and so many averus that are bad, let's say, mitzvahs lo sa'aseh, and it's not the case that every time there's an avera in the Torah, so there's also a story about somebody who violates the avera, and then there's another extra mitzvah to remember the story. So why is Lashon Hara so lucky? Why is Lashon Hara this way? That you have to have an extra mitzvah to remember it. So this was a topic that Yitzchok Isaac shared, who was the Mashkiach from the Slobodka Yeshiva, discusses in the Sichas Musar. His paper is called Lekat Sichas Musar. So there he discusses that Lashon Hara is a uniquely challenging mitzvah. That there are challenges that are contained in Lashon Hara you don't find anywhere else. And to illustrate the point, he notes that when you have a concept called Avak Lashon Hara, this second degree Lashon Hara. So included in Avak Lashon Hara is even things that are less overt. So if I say something nasty about somebody, that's Lashon Hara. If I say something that I mean to be nice, but it comes out harmful, so that's Avak Lashon Hara. And you could ask, well, what do I want? What do you want from me? If you tell me not to be nasty, okay, so I won't be nasty. But if you tell me, don't even accidentally come out nasty when I'm trying to be nice, well, that's the whole point, is that I wasn't trying to be nasty. So what do you want from me? So what this reflects is that Lashon Hara is a uniquely challenging mitzvah. It's not the kind of mitzvah that you can just wake up in the morning and go about your day and think you'll be able to protect yourself against the avers. So if you want to eat kosher food, so you know that before you eat something, it'll check the hashkafa. It doesn't require a constant kind of awareness. But when it comes to the human sensitivities that are involved in Lashon Hara, so it's very hard to protect against this unless you are going to constantly work on it. You have to constantly be aware and to think in advance about what kind of scenarios can come up. Because letting this go until the moment and then I'll deal with the challenge when it comes up, it's just not going to work. And how do we know this? Because look at Miriam. Right, it's really a neva, I think, that here we're trying to avoid Lashon Hara, and the Torah seems like it's a little bit putting Miriam in a negative light, and especially Miriam, the tzaddikas, such a major role model of ours, so that she should be portrayed in a negative way, that she should be a mitzvah associated with her after her whole life of tzaddikas is a little bit jarring, but in any event, apparently it's important enough that this cautionary tale be a part of our awareness. And maybe that's not to the point that both the Ramban here has a way of saying this, and the Rambam also in Mishneh Torah in Hilchos Tumas Tzaras has a similar formulation. Because if you look at Miriam, so here Miriam's a tzaddikus indeed, and Miriam loved Moshe, and Miriam only wanted the best for him, and Miriam raised Moshe. Miriam couldn't possibly be a better person or have meant better, or have cared more about the person she was talking about. And yet, with all that, she still trips over Lashon Hara. So what hope is there for the rest of us? So the only hope is that we have her experience to learn from, that we can remember my Samaria, and we can try to hone our own sensitivities, so we can hope that we'll be better off. But that's a lifelong endeavor. And that takes a lot of practice, and that's why I think to explain the Haggis of Klal Yisrael, why the past 100 years or so since the Chafetz Chaim wrote his Sefer, and we have such a focus on Shmiras HaLashon, the Chafetz Chaim Heritage Foundation, and all of the attention, which sometimes people think is disproportionate, but I don't think that's the case, that is given specifically to this Avera in the Torah, among other things, is a reflection of the fact that it really requires a tremendous sensitivity and awareness and focus. Otherwise, we're for sure going to mess up, and it's a constantly complicated decision that everything in Lashon Hara is a judgment call between what is necessary and appropriate and what isn't. Sometimes it's very important that you do say something. Sometimes it's the opposite. So, yes, there's always the ability to hide behind one argument or the other, but you still have to answer to God. And that means we have to explain in Shemayim after 120, we're going to have to account for our judgment calls. So we spend a life honing the judgment, and that's essentially what this mitzvah is saying. So, for example, there's a Rashi at the beginning of Parshas Shlach, and we generally don't get to talk about Shlach in Parshas Shir. So the beginning of Parshas Shlach, there's a Rashi which is hard to understand, because Rashi says, why does Baloscha, the end of Baloscha, this story of Miriam, why does that come right before the beginning of Shlach, which is a story of the Meraglim? So Rashi quotes the idea that Miriam spoke Lashon Hara and the Meraglim spoke Lashon Hara, and Harishayim Halalu, these are the Meraglim, Hayalahem, Likach, Musar. They should have learned the lesson of Miriam not to do this. And it's a hard comment, because it sounds like it's a kal v'chomer. Oh, what Miriam did was bad, so what they did was worse. And that's not really the case, because they spoke about land, doesn't have any feelings. Miriam spoke about a human being. So how could you say that there's any kind of a Kal Vachomer here? And in fact, the Gemara says the opposite. The Gemara says, in Erechim, if you want to know how bad Lashon Hara is, look at the Meraglim. They spoke about Eitz and V'Avonim. They spoke about land. And look how much trouble they got in. So all the more so, if you speak about people, oh, for sure that's Gefela. So it seems from there that it's much worse to speak about people than to speak about the land. So what seems to be the point here is that the message of Miriam is that one has to work very carefully in advance on any negativity that they have, any tendency to put things in a bad light. So that's very, very dangerous. And look, even if Miriam herself, with everything going for her, could have this problem, so certainly the rest of us who don't come from such a strong foundation, so then the message is we have to start working on this. And that's the lusser of Miriam. So the same way we do certain things in halacha to try to train ourselves to be sensitive, so too, the Meraglim, for them to run off right away and indulge in negativity, that is a betrayal of the message of Miriam that this needs practice, that this needs a focus and a retraining of one's attitude. And perhaps that's what Rashi is telling us, not that what they did was worse, but that they missed the opportunity to learn from her behavior, and that's where Hayilah and Likach Moses. So one message of Miriam is this idea that has to be a constant focus. This is something that we have to work on all the time. Maybe that's why we find Klal Yisrael devoting so much attention to this, because it's so easy to make a mistake or a misjudgment, even if we're well-meaning, unless we keep this in mind. I think that's one message of focusing on Miriam specifically. A second message of focusing on Miriam specifically, and this maybe we'll have to expand more on at a different time, but if you think about it, so here Miriam is the Iker story of Lashon Hara in the Torah, right? Where the clearest case where there is Lashon Hara and a consequence. And the story of Miriam is not what we normally relate to as Lashon Hara. It's not that nowadays we talk about a distinction that what's Yishemra is slander when you say something completely false. And Lashon Hara is when you relate true negative information. So that distinction really isn't in the Chumash, and it's not even in the Gemara. So that's a whole, we'll talk a different time about where that distinction comes from. But the Lashon Hara of Miriam is really not about any fact. It's not that she told somebody something that they didn't know. It's not about the relating of negative information. It's all about the spin. This is crucial. That the conversation with Miriam and Aaron, she put a certain take on what was going on in Moshe's family life, and that's the Lashon Hara we're talking about. And that's so much is Lashon Hara that we encounter nowadays, that it's not even about any information that you're conveying. It's about the read, the spin, the perspective that we impose on the facts that we see, and you do phenomenal damage that way. And that's a very tremendous point. And just that clock a little fast. Okay, so a few minutes to finish the point. Clock's a little drop fast. That there is a whole discussion as well, just to try to say this point quickly, that there was a Gemara, which is hard to understand the Gemara. The Gemara has a statement that Lashon Hara in front of the person is not Lashon Hara. It's presumably something else, and presumably at least Habanus Bnei Chaver Rabbim and other things. But the Gemara says it's not, according to one opinion of the Gemara, it's not Lashon Hara. So we probably don't possibly like that Gemara. We probably understand it in a very limited way. Most of the Sfarim don't record such a thing. But Maral of Prad, he did understand that that was the case. And it's not Lashon Hara if the person is present. So the Chafetz Chaim criticizes him on this. Chafetz Chaim disagrees with this. And he says, I'll bring you a raya that it's not true. Because the Iker story of Lashon Hara in the Torah is Miriam. And according to one day in the Medrash, Moshe was in the room at the time. So there, apparently it's called Lashon Hara, even though Moshe was present. See, Maral is wrong. So the Sfarim that are kind of like the intellectual descendants of the Maral, like the Putner and the Pachad Yitzchak and Shuas and Moshe Shapiro, a few others, they all defend the Maral at this point, and they have a similar approach where they basically say there's two types of Lashon Hara, just to say it very quickly. It says if you're just relating negative information, that's one type of Lashon Hara. Then there's another kind of Lashon Hara where it's not about facts, but it's about the lack of being damachaschus. It's about putting a certain spin on something that puts it in a negative light. So says all of these writers that when it comes to factual, straight-out facts, so then, yes, if the person is present, it's takanat lashon hara. It's something else, maybe, but it's takanat lashon hara. But when it's this type of lashon hara, the lack of being dan l'chaschus, basically the spin, that's what was going on with Miriam, so then it's not going to help that the person is there. And I think you can extrapolate from there that it highlights that the spin is basically all-powerful. You can put a negative spin on anything you want. You can make anything look bad. We see this every day, especially in the middle of a presidential campaign. But you see, you can make anything in the world look bad. And there's no defense. Nothing can be said to change that, because it's all the outside perspective imposed on any fact. If I say a fact about somebody, you can argue, is the fact true or not? But if I say, oh, somebody did this for this motive, for this reason, for this ulterior motivation, so there's nothing anyone could ever say to disprove that. So you can do phenomenal damage with the spin. And it doesn't matter, the person could be there, it could be shrine, if I have a kind, it's not going to make a difference. So that is, again, a very powerful message of Miriam specifically, that we should keep this in mind, because it's not what we normally think of as Lashon Hara, and maybe that is the ikker Lashon Hara, is the perspective that you put on things, and that's also an important point here. And that's interesting, because Ramban, in the comments here, when Ramban is giving his whole speech about how Miriam was so such a reduced level of badness, everything here was good, she meant well, she loved him, she thinks, etc. So he says that, and Moshe wasn't even in the room at the time, you know, as if that makes it better. So this, on the one hand, is against that medrash or some note, okay, it's the Maharsha anyway, but the Ramban seems to be assuming against this medrash. But either way, it's bad for the Maharal, because the medrash seems to be against the Maharal, but the Ramban's language also seems like it, because he's saying, oh, it was so mild in the Lashon Hara, the person wasn't even there. As if to say that if the person was there, then that'd be even worse Lashon Hara. So either way, it doesn't help the morale's position, whether you say Moshe was there, or you say like the Ramban's formulation, they both seem to be against him, but the morale's point, and the ways understood by the Sfarim, I think it's a very powerful one, that the spin Lashon Hara that we're talking about here is so damaging that it wouldn't matter if a person was there to defend himself, there's really nothing they can do. And mention one more point about this, that there is a interesting Magen Avraham. Magen Avraham quotes the idea that all the different phrases that we have in the Brichas Kriya Shema, the bracha right before Kriya Shema in the morning, all in Avarava, all these various phrases, we have different connections to the Sheis Zechiras. So he says, L'hodos L'cha, that we say in that paragraph, to thank God, that's a reference to Mitzvah Zechiras Ma'aseh Miriam. The way he understands it is that our mouths were made to praise God and not to speak Lashon Hara. So it sounds like a little weak of a connection, because that's how we see Lashon Hara here, that, oh, because we're talking about something positive to do with our mouths, so it must mean do the positive thing and not do the negative thing. It's a little bit of a weak connection. So I think it's actually maybe a little bit more than that, that the Ramban writes in Mishneh Torah, when he's giving his whole speech, he says that people who speak Lashon Hara, so they first speak about people in general, but then they get even more cynical, and it's expanded, and they speak about the rabbis, and then they end up speaking Lashon Hara about God himself. That basically the cynicism, once you let it, negativity, once you let it out, it just gets getting worse and worse, and it's just going to keep expanding and go up to attacking God also. So when you say the L'hodos L'cha is to never Ma'aseh Miriam, it's telling you that if you indulge in negativity, it's going to come to the point where you can't praise God. That the ability to praise God, not just that you're using your mouth for something else that's not available right now, it's that the whole attitude that you need to praise God is going to be compromised and is going to deteriorate if you indulge in this act of Lashon Hara. So that's another very powerful message of the Chiras Ma'aseh Miriam, which comes out from our parsha. Okay, there is one more idea I wanted to say, because there are still a few more psukim. I promised you we'll do it one day. So, God willing, on Sunday we will talk about Inyanei Rosh Hashanah. Maybe 2 minutes at the beginning, just these last few psukim. But other than that, we're generally done.